Log Talk Radio.
This is Yasa Sagonige, a seventh great grandson of Sawanuka, keeper of the Holy Cherokee Ark, who during the American Revolution became first beloved man of the Cherokee, head man of the Upper, Middle, and Lower Cherokee. Please join us at 5 p.m. Pacific Time on Sunday evening and learn how you, regardless of ancestry, may gain the privilege of worshiping as you please, even using indigenous plant-based native sacraments. Aho. You have been led by the Spirit to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asaga of Peru, the current Kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine people of the Americas, the Holy Ones of Africa, shamans of the East, North, West, and South, or the present-day Anawehis of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times and their confidants from the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Holy Land, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. We have not been conquered, and we defy the established order. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.
It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow?
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius.
I'm Austin Powers, I like Gas Mojo. It's a very sexy and very switched on, yeah.
But you gotta have Gas Mojo, baby, yeah!
What a gas, baby, yeah!
I'm going to go back to the 60s and steal Austin Powers' Gas Mojo.
Hi folks, this is Will Bluewater speaking on behalf of GasMojo.net Engine Booster. Immediate 25% fuel savings with GasMojo.net in just 5 minutes after installation. And your grandma can do this. You just strap it on your fuel line, folks. Some customers report much greater savings. The GasMojo.net engine booster catalytically conditions any hydrocarbon fuel, be it gasoline, propane, diesel fuel. It's not a filter. It contains no metals, magnets, or toxic substances, and uses no electricity. The GasMojo.net engine booster unit is a specially designed tube containing a completely safe proprietary media. It's a passive fuel treatment process designed to disperse hydrocarbons for better performance and mileage, and also to break down carbon and other contaminants. Unlock your fuel's hidden energy potential now with GasMojo.net. And folks, you get a 100% money-back guarantee on this. I've got one on my car. It was developed by an old friend of mine, and he's an honorable person. You got to try it, folks, and go open a bank account now for all the money you're going to save. GasMojo.net, GasMojo.net. Just do it.
Hi, friends. This is your host, Will Bluewater. Tonight's show is kind of for Mormons only. In one way, and in another way not. Actually, Chief Rogers found some property that belongs to Mormons, and there's a lot of people inside and outside and on the edges of the Mormon Church that are continuing to look for truth, even though it might not be in the places you would expect to find it. But all I would ask is that you listen with an open mind tonight. Listen to the voice of the Spirit, and I might mention that don't be afraid of men. Brigham Young said, as far as he was concerned, the greatest sin could do would be afraid of men. Listen to your Heavenly Father inside you. Do some research. There's all kinds of information out there to back up what we've got to say, but we are Cherokee. And we're here to return something that belongs to you. But one thing I want you to know, the information you're going to hear from Dr. Rogers tonight was submitted to church historian Marlon Jensen, and he submitted it to general authorities. It was vetted, and the information was placed in the church archives. I know you're going to be excited about this. For me, this is an event of a lifetime. I'm not sure many of you will really appreciate the gravity of this information, but I'm sure the Holy Spirit will fill in the blanks. OCO again in Lee. This is your old friend Blue Otter coming to you from an undisclosed location in East Tennessee. You see, we had this little misunderstanding. We leased it to the white folks a couple hundred years ago, and anyway, it's a long story. I don't think we'll ever collect the back rent. Our guest this evening, and this is a really for me, and a lot of people have really been wanting to hear from Dr. Charles Jotlohi Rogers. Welcome, Chief Rogers. How are you?
Just fine, just fine. OCO to you, my brother.
And here's your sound. That is a Kingfisher.
Yes.
We always like to let folks know what I know you know what one sounds like, but I wanted the audience to know. And well, you've got a long story to tell. We've got a couple of hours, and this is your show. You're always welcome on here anytime you want to, and tell us about your path, Uku.
Yeah. Well, Wado, and I can't tell you how much I have looked forward to speaking with you and your audience. The I guess the best thing to do is to just tell the story as it led us back into the path that we Cherokees took originally. That our migration legend, I think, is always worth repeating, that we traveled over land a long time. And a long time for a Cherokee is literally a decade or more. And we came to the great waters, and we built rafts, and we crossed the ocean. And when we came to an island, we stopped there, and we lived there. And then people from the rubber tree forest came. And we couldn't live on the island compatibly because of our difference in our religious beliefs. And we fought with them to a standstill. And then we went on to the mainland. And in the mainland there, we found people who were more compatible with us. And we intermarried. And part of our original group was not for the intermarriage. And what I'd like to say, the more enlightened individuals that understand that the Great Spirit is the Great Spirit of all human beings, he led us up to the original place where the Chalagi or Chalangi people at that time, who, as they would have called themselves, where they started as this group in the Americas. We've always been people of the cliffs and the high countries, both the Native Americans and the people who came from the Mo, from the salt water. This has been for two reasons. One is defense in having the high ground. The other is that we always had something to protect. Life has never been simple for the Chalagi. We have information that must be protected in each generation. Our brothers, the Katuwa, know this so well. The presence that we had an ark that was not only to be carried into war, but was to be maintained. And for the presence of peace to be established also. So we would go up to the high country and we would operate out of caves, even though we would have houses built on the side of mountains and in the upland valleys. The thing that we liked best about why, and any Native American listening will understand this and nod his head yes, that's, we're the same way ourselves, is that the water as it first comes down the mountain is the purest. And we Chalagi people believe that, and actually know, if you'll allow me to say that, know that when we would pass away from the physical, and the spiritual would work its way back, we would always like to be near water or even buried with the sand of a river upon us, so that we could easily, our spirit could easily go back. And we actually even had a mechanical concept of how that worked, in that we would call rivers as we did everything that moved. We considered everything that moved to be alive. The wind was alive, the water was alive, the earth from time to time would move, and it was alive. And the stone man would come out of the earth, and that was alive, meaning the lava flows. We could see intelligent interaction between all things at one time or another, being alive when they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. If they're supposed to be still, the earth is still. If they're supposed to move, the earth moves. And so our concept is that we understand that this is all part of a design from the one God that we have. And we feel that all men have. And so we would always try to establish ourselves as high in the hills as possible, because then the water in the springs that came down were pure, and our soul could go back. Now, you could say, well, how could your soul go back? Well, it's really not that hard a concept to understand. The Chalangi said that we had seven heavens, and the first heaven started, the second heaven, pardon me, started right above the trees, and wasn't that far off. And the first heaven was in case you were infirmed and you were worried about could you go to heaven. It was to the left, and it was about 3 feet off the ground. And that sounds laughable, but that was the concept. However, I tend to think that if there is a mechanics, a physics to energy, and there is, we know that energy cannot be destroyed. It also cannot be increased. So you can't destroy it, you can't increase it, what we are as human beings. So the concept was that wherever a Chalangi, a Cherokee person was on the earth, that the entire earth was ours, not to be had in a selfish context, but to be shared with all men. But it was, we had a right to be wherever we were, and we had we also had the responsibilities that come with that right to be wherever we were. In being a brother to all men and to our sisters, and to treat them as we would be treated. Now, why the pure water? Why, what was the thing about going to water every day? We Cherokees would go to water if it was freezing. We would go down and wash ourselves and say our prayers in gratitude for the water. A good example of what a Chalangi, a Cherokee person, would do that was acceptable would be to go to water and to tell the water where you were at that you are connected to the long man,
the river, and
the river. And the river was connected to the ocean, and all the seas were connected together. And we knew that all water on earth, the groundwater was in springs, and sometimes it was to remain asleep, and sometimes it was to run. But it was all connected worldwide. And so it was very important that we were near water, because then our spirit would flow with that water to the oceans and then turn into the clouds and go up into heaven.
I bet they appreciated a good hot spring in the wintertime.
Absolutely, because you were, as a matter of fact, Sequoia himself, when he went to Mexico to find the Cherokee R speakers and the M speakers, they were the same people who spoke the ancient religious language. He lived at the Hacienda Patiño in the state of Coahuila, and he had a little house there near Standing Rock's people, who are wonderful, wonderful people. His descendants still live in Oklahoma to this day. But Standing Rock was one super individual. But that's why the Cherokees were fanatics for being near water, because if water was running, it was alive, and it had purpose, and that purpose was to carry you back to the Great Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, my ancestors, I've got a cousin who lives in Florida, and for years and years and years, there was this little thing in the back of my head that was saying somebody else in the family just has to know something about our Cherokee genealogy. And it, anyway, I met Bill Hanson. I mean, this guy grew up in Alabama, and he grew up in a house that looked exactly like the houses the Cherokees used to build. One main roof, and kind of two dwellings with a breezeway between, you know, surrounded by porch. But anyway, he knew the names of all our ancestors all the way back to 1500, and we were from Shooting Springs near Chunky Gown Mountain in North Carolina in the old Wolf Clan territory. But that's that. They like the highlands, and they like the fresh water.
You know, the fresh water was to be among springs and small creeks that ran. What was as if your family had increased in the number of children and life that you were surrounding yourself with. It was the sound of the water was the sound of life itself, and it was a music to the ear of the Chalagi. It still is to this day, as the music of children. It also is the music of life. And so for us to be surrounded by both of those, we were completely in peace with our surroundings.
Oh. Well,
the go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Okay. The Valley of the Mountains of the Moon, where our first Kituwa was in the Americas. And I know my Kituwa brothers would enjoy hearing this, but the Native American tribes on two sides of us actually used the word Kituwa for their name, for the word church. And so the Kituwa today will tell you, oh, the name means something that came down from on high, meaning something that came down from way up on the mountain, and so these other recipients of the Chalagi religion, that's what they would call church, was Kituwa. One of these tribes even had a word K-O-I-N in their dictionary, which was filed in 1948 after 30 years of being compiled from a searcher in Central and South America. And so our name at that time, Cheriqui in Spanish, Cheriqui in the Guaymi language, meant people of the Valley of the Mountains of the Moon. And so all of our neighbors knew who we were, and the losing of who we were and understanding who we were, therein lies the tale that you, Blue Otter, and I will cover tonight, because I think it's a fascinating tale, and A, it's accurate, B, it's historical, C, we know it occurred, we have linguistics evidence, and there's a lesson for all of us to learn, and for the Chalagi, the Chalangi, to relearn. Because the reason that we have lost our place is that we forgot the early lessons.
Oh.
We lived in that Valley of the Mountains of the Moon, and we conquered other tribes not by war, but by brotherhood and by sharing with them the religion that had come across the water to us, and this is 600 years before the time of Christ, so it wasn't Christianity per se. We knew who Jesus was, but we knew him in his Old Testament names, Shiloh, or Shiloh. And and the Morning Star, and so we knew all of this stuff 800 years before Europe or Rome had an inkling of these names. It was a time period in which, for some reason, we were chosen to receive the earliest recorded human transcription of the name of the one God. And the reason I say one God is that it's a matter of understanding that just because something is spiritual doesn't mean it's metaphysical only. I really see the world in a more concrete manner than the best things that confirm the great spirit come from that which is real, as opposed to that which is theoretical or hypothetical. So a good example of this would be in astrophysics. In 1895, a brilliant guy that Einstein studied basically said hydrogen is the fabric of the universe. It is our lightest element on our table of elements. And so there's nothing below that. Well, of course, we know better now. There's hundreds of things smaller than that make up hydrogen. But at that time, the concept was just purely physical, that the hydrogen had an attraction, it grew together, it compressed, it exploded, it made the universe as we know it. Einstein studied that, and he said that it's the first time that it dawned on him that there was a God for real. Even though he had been raised Jewish, he had fallen in love with just one side of reality, the physical side of reality, and there's so many things more true than that. And so Einstein at that point said, "It's in the details that you're going to find odd." And so the question always has been, since 1895, we were the first people to be able to physically define the question in the history of man, where did it all come from? So you have two paths you can take. You can take one path, and it's that it has always been, and it will always be. As we know in astrophysics, those are the exact description of energy. It has always been and it will always be. Or you can say that it all came from nothing. And a Cherokee, a Chalagi, will not say that it just all came from nothing like magic. And so thus... We're the ones that think that the world is, even though it's metaphysical, and even though there are spirit things, and even though there are energy forms that we cannot understand in the dimension that we're in while we're here, and that goes for the very concept of Cherokee is, a Chalagi is, Chalangi is we are. Race is never been a part of our thinking. We always had a clan, a newcomer's clan, to where non-Cherokees, regardless of who they were, if they came to us with a good heart, we would accept them. They would go to the clan, and they would learn how to be a Chalangi, or Charagi, even with the R, as the ancient Cherokee religious people referred to themselves in the later days. These are the people who occupied at one time about 20% of the United States and held treaties as far north as the Winnebagoes and as far south as the great Caddo cities on the Gulf Coast, which in the 1500s could could pony up 10,000 warriors with supplies and weapons in 4 hours in cities that were well-armed, well-designed, well-built, and cultures that were incredibly efficient. These North American, Native Americans, were something to behold. They could protect themselves. They had done away with war among themselves because they learned how to store grain, and that each city had an obligation based upon its population to store X amount of grain in these huge cisterns in the ground that kept the grain dry. And so the war had disappeared from the world of the Native American around the Gulf Coast. No longer did they fight over food when drought came. They had that conquered, and so these were very, very, especially for 11, 12, 13, and 1400 A.D. These were very cultured and intellectual people. The Chalagis, by the time we got to the United States in the southern part, we had reduced from our use of mathematics to where in 1825 it was just remembered that we had a word for the word 1,000, which we called the ancient ones 100. And so at one time we were big counters and keepers of calendars and such like that, as our Mayan brothers and were in the south. We came originally where the two oceans came the closest, and that's where even to this day there's a volcano with our name on it, a river, a bay, and the valley. And we decided, because there was such an input from the south of people who had such a deep belief in magic, that we could not penetrate their it was impossible to become friends with them, because they were unpredictable, as they did not see the universe as belonging to them, that they had dominion over the universe, as the Chalagi believed. The people who lived their life strictly on a magical basis, they are the subjects of a chaotic universe and world, as opposed to one that always, if you learn enough, makes sense and becomes everything has its place, and everything is acting as expected, except for the human beings. Now, we've done really well in some areas, but anyway, to get back to that, so we decided to go to the north, and we had a relationship with everybody that we passed, the Mayans, the Toltecs, the Mixtecs, between Mexico City and the Rio Bravo, or as we call it, the Rio Grande. When you get north of the river, that was the Rio Grande, was where it hit the Gulf of Mexico. That was the land of the ferocious ones. And so as we went north and we worked our way through the Mayan populations, through the Toltecs, Mixtecs, they all related to us really well, and we had a special standing. Even in Texcoco, the lake in the Valley of Mexico, we lived there for a time, and we were left alone. The one thing that when we were threatened by their shaman with this type of incantation or that type of incantation, we knew it was not the intentions of our Creator that would happen to us, and we knew it was a human threat, and we would literally laugh at it. You could not scare us because we knew the Creator, and we knew the goodness of the Creator.
Mm-hmm.
And we did not have an angry mm-hmm. or warlike God. The as we worked north out of Mexico, for example, between the Rio Grande and Mexico City, there was 150 different Native American tribes in just that zone. For example, California, before the colonists came from Europe, it had 258 different languages, indigenous languages in California alone. And all of the United States was in that manner. They would have some tribes that were larger than others, but there was all kind of people that stretched back into history that had been living there for a long time. So we passed the River of the Ferocious Ones, and at that point, the best description when and I think this is good to cover right now, that the Chalagi, Cherokee, described something from their heart. They always tried to when they gave a name to some, even to a child, it was something that was heartfelt. And when we said that the Ferocious Ones lived at the mouth of the Rio Grande, we weren't kidding. The settlers of Stephen F. Austin had written about the last descendants in the early Spanish padres that had come to Padre Island, had written about the Ferocious Ones, and the women were a very petite, 6 feet in height, and the men were closer to seven. And so they were a handful to get past.
Didn't Cabeza? I think Cabeza Baca encountered those guys.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And they would live in the sand dunes and use palm thatches to cover them up and protect them from the wind, and then they would fish and things like that. One of the early Spanish stories from Padre Bahia, who was given he and a brother had received a land grant from the King of Spain, and the brother's land grant, oddly enough, was over in Tamaulipas, and was very nice grass range with the Rio Grande River coming by it, and the priest brother, his part of the land grant was South Padre Island, and the desert out there, and he went out to survey his land grant, and the fierce ones had captured a person who had come down in their territory they were not antisocial, but you better not come looking for trouble. And this guy had come down to make a serious coup of some sort and take it home to his people, and he went to the Ferocious Ones, and he had been sly enough to get away with it. And bless his heart, he apparently had harmed somebody in the process, because they basically had him tied up and were trimming pieces off of him for dinner when the padre arrived. And so the padre never went back out there again.
Now we're talking about the Atacapans, right?
That's right. And so at that point, we moved on north till we came to the Mississippi, and we went north up the Mississippi. And we were good at making friends, and I hope I'm an example of that tonight, because we have great love for all people, and so they went north on up the big waters of the Mississippi, and finally came to a mound up in Ohio, which had been occupied by the Ancient Ones, and they'd rebuilt the fortification around it, and we lived there for 600 or 700 years. According to the Lenape, the Delaware Wallum Olam, which was finally written down, I believe the 16th century, but it had been an oral tradition of history. The Lenape people had absolutely a superior concept of keeping history for their people. And they're a fine people too. And so anyway, they basically said, oh yeah, we know who the Chalagis were here, because we fought them for 600 or 700 years. By that time, when they formed a confederation of other people that said, let's get the Chalagi pushed out of here, they did. And we were good hunters, and we established boundaries and we were good stewards of the land, which all Native Americans were in that time period. So then we went over toward Virginia and went as high up as New York State, and worked all through Kentucky. As we came down, over 500 or 600 years, we moved slowly. Thomas Jefferson had on Monticello, on his lands, a Chalaguine mound, in which every seventh year the Cherokee would come and pay their respects to those people who had lived there. And they knew this up into the 1700s. But yet we had crossed through there in 1300 to 1400. So there was an advanced group, and then there was another group, and then there was a third group. And that's the reason why we have different dialects within Cherokee. Now, the advanced group, the first to build the Catoomba Mound, these were the R and M speakers who spoke the ancient religious language that was brought to us by the people who had crossed the Atlantic Ocean and had come to where the two oceans come the closest in the Americas. And these are the people that had joined tribes with our tribe. And we had become the same people. This advance party knew to go to the south, and that's where they went. The other party stayed in the north, and they intermixed and attracted more Iroquois speakers. And so thus, by the time 1700 came, the year 1700, that mark within those centuries came, the Chalagee in the southern part were speaking words that had M's and R's in them, and they were mostly Hebrew in their religious practices, and those priests had gone out as missionaries into the Cherokees that did not speak the M and the R, that were basically an Iroquois language, and they had established themselves now.
Before you go to that, though, you mentioned the K-O-I-N. I want to remind everybody that Cohen means priest in Hebrew.
Yes.
And we know from that there's a Cohen haplotype. We can tell from DNA. And oddly enough, a few years ago, a Catholic priest in Denver decided that he was going to have some DNA work done and found out that 30% of his congregation that were Catholics had this marker. And among the average Jewish population, you'll get less than 10%. So
way less than 10%.
Like 3%.
When they talk about DNA, and there is a Cherokee, an ancient Cherokee warning, not to ever allow anybody to take your spit, S-P-I-T, your saliva. And this was documented by Mooney, who was a researcher for the Bureau of Ethnology,
mm-hmm.
which is now what we call the Smithsonian, as you Blue Otter are well aware of, and so Mooney just wrote it down, and I assumed that I said, well, this may be the first Chalagee story that I've ever heard that had to be from somebody else because it makes no sense.
Mm-hmm.
And see, it's just a matter of at what time does it make sense.
Uh-huh.
The stories are all out there, and as time goes by, a story will come into being.
Uh-huh.
And so here, we had offers 15, 14 years ago for people to, at their expense, fly out to us, and they wanted our saliva, and this is a true story. They said it won't cost you guys anything. We're a research group. We want to come out. We want your saliva, and we want to. I know it. And so I'm having read when I was a young man about don't allow any, don't spit in front of braves that you do not know. Don't spit in front of people. If you have to clear your throat, don't do it to where anybody could find that.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, Sal, that's bizarre. And then...
Well, we used to take umbilical cord and go three hills toward the east and bury it.
Yes.
And now we know about stem cells.
Yes, yes, yes. And so here are all these things going on that that you're thinking to yourself, oh, what a primitive imagination to have come up with that. And then you find out that, well, I'm right. There was somebody primitive involved, but it was me because I didn't understand what I was looking at. And so I told the people, no, we will not. I'm sorry, but we won't do that. And I came back and said no. And they said, why? And I said, well, we have a warning against it. And they said, you have a warning against it? And I said, yeah, that's right. We have a warning against it. And it was from a serious person, a known seer or visionary, as it would be. So anyway,
Before you go forward with that, you know, the Cherokees here in Tennessee, they had a DNA study done. And the matter of fact, some of the details are on the History Channel show and Who Really Discovered America, where they talk about Joe Sitting Owl and the central band of Cherokees. These are descendants of doubleheads, Chickamauga.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows
good people.
It shows the guy who did the research, and he misrepresented the results, mm-hmm, from like 30% to 3%.
Yeah,
and you see they lie.
Well, yeah, tell them they lie indeed, as Standing Rock's people once said. But here's the trick. If you know the Unagi trick to the DNA, is that once you're back, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Probably 10 generations, you cannot test for ethnicity because the gene, even if you were descended directly from, the only way they can connect ethnicity from, say, 400 years ago, 500 years ago, they cannot do it through allos. The three gene groupings which denotate an ethnical presentation within that human, hair, shape of nose, shape of lips, shape of skull, on and on and on, not counting how we think, which is a whole other thing that they have no idea how many of those three gene combinations are necessary for how we think, but after that period of time, you're going to be below the plus or minus of the testing itself, which disappears at 6%. So from the beginning, it was phony.
Uh-huh.
The haplotype is carried down by fathers. And they're not going to show ethnicity because the haplotype is only one half of the all the females involved in the committee that built you going back forever will not be taken into consideration, and so that means that,
uh-huh,
if you were Hebrew, whereas the only thing that's taken into consideration is your mother Jewish.
Uh-huh.
Okay, well, those people would be out. So they finally found this X chromosome, an X haplotype.
Well, what the rabbis told me is, if you're under covenant, if your mother was Jewish, but if you have an unbroken mind, as I do, the tribe designation came through the father, and a lot of people don't know that.
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. The matrilineal part of the Hebrew and of the Cherokee is the same, but the father is always known, and so that only applied to property, not to are you Chalagi.
Mm-hmm.
Only it was a legalistic concept dealing with the house and the lands of production
and the ownership of the children.
And we'd accept people to the 11th generation, you know, single drop of blood. And so,
well, yeah, well, the Hebrews do also.
Mm-hmm.
If you have one drop, you're considered one of the chosen people. And if you have one drop of Chalagi, you're considered one of the principal people. And we're not changing that, because now we know that this huge amount of money that was put out to find the quest to find the admixtures from Europe has always been huge. Meriwether Lewis was a Welsh person, first language. It was Welsh at home, as was Thomas Jefferson, and as was George Catlin, the famous Western painter. The William and Clark expedition was to basically see who was out there, and B, find out if the Mandans actually had admixed with the Welsh in the 12th century. As the Conestoga reported to Colonel Sevier, Nolichucky Jack, and this letter and this meeting was detailed by Major Stoddard in 1806 and sent to Thomas Jefferson. That letter exists to this day in a museum.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they said yes. And the Cherokee chief they were talking to knew exactly what entry that would be on the white man's calendar, on the Onegi calendar.
Uh-huh.
And he knew exactly that in the 12th century that these 10 boatloads of people came to Mobile Bay.
Uh-huh.
And went up the river, and eventually the Mandans there, when George Catlin needed them, spoke 22 words in Welsh, which had the same precise meaning.
And they had the same boats, the little bull boats that the Welsh had.
That's right.
An interesting thing you said about Lewis. Lewis is a derivative of Levis, Levi. The original Welsh people were tribe of Simeon, which is absorbed into Judah.
Yeah,
there were some mean people too.
The Exodus of Alba. It was the Exodus
Alba, of Scotland.
Of the white people to the north.
Mm-hmm. That's the
from the Holy Land.
The original name of Scotland, Alba.
Yeah, Alba. And it was that Exodus right after the Ice Age. As the Ice Age receded, the people, the Exodus of Alba from the Holy Land came and followed the ice as it melted to the north, populated the seacoast, the island of Ireland, and the west coast of England long millennia before the Anglo-Saxons came down. So when we got to the Ketuwa Mount, it was the second Ketuwa. Now, there were many Ketuwas. They would build up on a mound. When they didn't have a mound, they would build on a mound. Because they needed to go up higher at all times, because it was part of their belief that the higher they were, the closer they were to the heaven where the deity lived, where Yohiwa lived, and so thus it was a symbolic that we knew that no, we weren't in heaven, but it was a way of paying respect. It was saying, here, this structure is the way we think, is what it said. I mean, we weren't foolish people at all. And I doubt that any Native American is foolish in their culture or their ways. When you get down and study exactly what their environment is, how they look at things, I find more truth in that culture than I do in our pop culture. The one of the big downfalls is, and I think that this is important, and I can't speak for any other tribe. And as a matter of fact, I cannot speak for the Chalagi that are not the R speakers and the M speakers. I can't speak to their history. We went through so many ridiculous phases when the whole thing came from there was a backlash against the priests. There was allegations that they had let power go to their head, and instead of being in service in Gadugi, they were acting as Europeans would act.
Mm-hmm.
In taking privileges with women that were not their wives and such like that, and so that is what was said. Now, what was actually happening, I believe, was that the other religions that had come down that were not based upon one God,
mm-hmm.
We were in conflict within ourselves and within pardon me, within our own people, we were in conflict, and so. The missionary priest to the north that had decided we need to leave South Carolina and Georgia and Tennessee and go up to the various tribes that Chalagi that dotted the landscape at that time that would be on one side of the neighboring we mistakenly think of things as being like small kingdoms. But the truth is, as you came through and as people filled in behind you from a different tribe, it was like a lava lamp. There was a matrix that was in constant motion. Now, slow motion, grant you over decades and decades, people were moving in, people were moving out. This was changing. These towns were growing. These towns were shrinking, and it was all based upon where the where the soil was and the water and the amount of room needed, all the things that control modern towns and civilizations controlled us too. But we would have small encampments of Chalagi people, 200 or 300 here, 200 or 300 there. We were probably 60,000 to 70,000 people before the diseases hit from the 1541 visit of the Spaniards. At that time, and such great harm is done. It's like
talk about DeSoto.
Oh yeah, DeSoto.
See, he was right down in this area, near Pulaski. And,
right.
Yeah, we remember. And he wrote in his report to the Vatican that that there were. We weren't all brown haired and black haired and brown eyed.
We were admixture.
Yeah,
we were absolutely an admixture then. The when DeSoto captured by saying, "Please, I wish you to go with me," he didn't really capture her, but we had an empress at that time, as families provided the chiefs and they provided the priests.
Was that Kofita Cheki?
Yes, yeah. And when we take on that responsibility for producing a chief or producing a priest, their training started when they were 6, 7, 8 years old, and it was one of service. It was not raised to lead by power, but it was those people were raised to lead by service to the tribe, and so that's how we had 20% of America under our sway at that time is through this type of system. Now, when the priest war came and Chalagi was killing Chalagi, and the priests were murdered in the northern part, at that time the southern part pulled back and said, okay, we do speak a somewhat different language, a different dialect, radically different. We have sounds that they don't have, and so thus apparently we're going to have to leave here. And that was decided at the insistence of the Europeans who were settling on the coast, taking the Cherokee women as slaves. Because they were good workers and could do this and could do that and could operate stuff. Matter of fact, to this day, the black people that they married into, there's a book called Cherokee Women, which
mm-hmm.
which says that yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I read it like 5, 6 years ago.
And they said basically this strong female that could raise a house, could build a house or raise a family and work and produce money was a Cherokee trait.
Mm-hmm. It's like Grandfather David Craker told me. He's a Ottawahee in the White River Band. He says Cherokee women are like grizzly bears. All you can do is get out of the way.
That's right. They're very independent. My mother was absolutely one of those people. pardon me. So anyway, the when that occurred, at that time, our nation was in trouble because we didn't have adequate leadership. It was leadership based upon popularity, mm-hmm. not upon training. And with the Europeans coming over and wanting more and more land, because the problem is that we were not part of the American dream. The American dream was that our grandchildren would have a piece of land to own, as opposed to our people will have a piece of land to live on.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the popularity contest. That's exactly how my seventh great grandfather Samanuka was overthrown, because he wanted to defend the land, but you know, Old Tassel was a little more popular, and
that's all it took. It was a new world, and it looks like our world now, because we're I think it was the beginning. We look at it as the beginning of when we fell from greatness, is that when we quit teaching ethics, and we quit teaching responsibility, and we quit teaching that spiritualism is real as the ground below your feet, and that there is no magic in the world. When we quit teaching that, the next thing you know, the Europeans are knocking on our door. We're not a coherent or cohesive culture. We've got differences in religion that are causing violence, chalagi on chalagi. And the next thing you know, the South group says, we're going back to Ketuba, to Karaki, the Valley of the Mountains of the Moon, and we're going to get back to God and get back to nature, and we're not going to do this. Our brother Sequoia, he was in Tennessee, and his wife used to pick up shrouds of pottery and things, and he would see the markings on them, and some of the old people would tell him, oh, that's Rish, that's the man who would lead men. That's Yo, that symbol's Yo, and that's the spirit of the Great Spirit. That's the Great Spirit himself. That's his symbol. And little things like that. When he was a young man, he did not understand it, but he kept piecing it together, and he was working in a general type of trading post for a while, and dispensing whiskey to the traders and trappers, and he saw enough of the Unagi dark side to last him a lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And so that he sobered up himself, and he became a principled person. He just wasn't going to do this any longer. And he's not going to become a warrior so much as a person of peace. And so at that time when they left, we were left with A, losing a war, B, betting on the wrong horse in the revolution, because we did not see the hearts of the people in front of us. We didn't know them. We hated them because of land disputes, but we didn't take time to understand why what their land dispute was with mm-hmm. the British, and then we would have said, I get it, you're the Chalagi, mm-hmm. you're the guy on the short end of the stick, I see.
Well,
yeah.
We call them the scum of the Eastern Ocean. I mean, they, from our perspective, and you know, talk about Old Tassel, you know, and this is a very famous quote. He said, many proposals have been made to us to adopt your laws, your religion, your manners, and your customs. We would be better pleased with beholding the good effects of these doctrines on your own practices than with hearing you talk about them.
That's right. That's right. And so speech that is not real is not human speech. You've got to mean what you say. It's really unimportant what language you speak. What's important is what are you saying? Because to a chalangi, it's very important that it's what you're saying. Chief Hicks once said, that old warrior that he is, that Red Chief, and he's head of the Texas Cherokees. Pappy Hicks. He had done a lifetime of military service, mm-hmm. in war zones, and one of his crowd said, "Well, if they ask us at the border, what is this feather? I'll just lie to them." And Pappy Hicks said, "Chalagi, we don't lie to anybody. He said, don't lie. Tell them what it is. And then if you have to go somewhere and suffer some consequences at their hands for their law, so be it. But at least you didn't break your law by lying."
Mm-hmm. And this is the guy that ran the secret war in Laos, and
exactly.
You know, he's a Green Beret, and he's a mutual friend, and I interviewed him.
Yeah, remarkable.
Oh, unbelievable.
Yeah. So Pappy Hicks just told his tribal member, don't lie. He said, don't break your laws. If you have to pay consequences for breaking their laws, that's another thing. But don't lie. Don't break your laws. And so that is one of the things that we got away from. Now, we're left without an army. We're left without a victory. The Europeans have grandchildren, and they're all wanting part of the American dream. And we're sitting on their property. We're not cohesive in our thoughts. Our ethics have just gone to pieces. They're selling whiskey to us hand over fist, and we should have known better.
Well, our UCA had a vision, and he was told, we're not to drink alcohol anymore. And that was the UCA back in the 1600s, the oldest recorder, but I forget his name, but yeah. We knew
it
was bad.
Of course. You can self-medicate, but if it means that you're gonna be incapacitated as a principal person, I'd say it's a bad trade. And we traded for other stuff too, which is our fault. Is our fault.
You're something happened with your microphone. Need to get back closer to it.
Okay. There we go. It is our fault that when we take the wrong path, it is our fault. And so here came trade beads, and they had brilliant reds and blues and whites and greens and colors that looked like a miracle had happened.
The next new thing.
Yeah, the next new thing. So right away we can't really be Chalagi. Because we've lost our way, we've lost our ethics, we've lost our concepts of the Creator. The next thing you know, we're decorating ourselves with beads instead of river shells, and huge silver and bronze and brass plaques on us, and all manner of things to make us look splendid. And so we're
turning over. I think I looked at the table of what the British swapped us for their goods, as far as deer hides, and I think a rifle was like 7, but a shirt was like 15.
Oh yes, if it had a cotton,
yeah,
especially because when we would go to water, when we were obeying. Cleanliness and washing our food and going to water and washing our face and our hands and thanking God for water that brought life and takes us to the hereafter and is all connected in the world and is always going to be here for us. When we quit doing that, we wound up drinking and looking like I don't know what, something out of a Wild West show. And the next thing you know, when they finally came to take our land, they built us a big stone building, a brick building, at New Echota. And we all started wearing the latest thing out of England in 1821, the latest thing out of England was the high-collar tuxedo shirt. And so we all dressed up in tuxedos and went down into a brick building with no view of the sky, with fire, and we all got in there and started giving speeches. In the meantime, the Unagis are pouring over boundaries of our land, taking it from us while we all made speeches.
Mm-hmm.
It's the saddest thing ever when you think about what occurred, and it continues to this day.
Well, they remove us to Oklahoma, and then five years later, one of the Cherokee senators decided he was going to ride back to Georgia, and the whites had burned out the land and moved on.
Yeah, the mountain land is in Tennessee too. You have to know where you're farming at, what's going on. I know a lot of the stuff that we have a tendency to try to blame other people for, but as far as being incapacitated as a human being, that's our fault. And as far as being so vain as wanting to look like a person of great achievement without becoming a person of great achievement, that is our fault. So we've got to get back to the basics. I can't speak for any other people. I can only speak for myself as far as that goes. But the membership that we have, and it's growing greatly every month, thanks to the effort and the communication skills of you, Blue Otter, a lot of people are hearing about us. We had a time in which we were going to study exactly all the questions and come up with all the answers as to how did we get here. So we had a reassessment time, and that ran from 2001 until about to 6 months ago. And the only people that we let in, I can count them on one hand.
People like Carol Shoemaker.
Yep. The only people we let in during that time period was you in 2003, and four or five others.
I can say is, pshaw.
No.
But I really appreciate it. I'll tell you what, this effort that I've done for all these years has been a very lonely one, and sometimes very depressing. And you know, you called me before you got kidnapped, and that kept me going.
Well, you were in. I heard it. You know, I heard, and I said he's in. He is Chalagi. He's in, and he understands, and we're all on a journey. And so at that point, we had to decide, how did we get here, and what's the truth of it? And then how come we Cherokees are separated one from the other, which is ridiculous? And why would, and this is a touchy issue in some camps, but speaking for ourselves, we were the people from Georgia and South Carolina and Tennessee, and of course many of us came from North Carolina and such, as they had pockets in which the ancient religion was taught and the ancient language was known. And then the pressure from the north, the Iroquois speakers that had different religions, we were all at peace but separated when the Europeans came, but all of our power, but then we'd been cut down to 18% of our numbers.
Like Red Bird Smith said, he says perhaps it was just a training. He says, but now is our time to stand up.
Red Bird is right. He speaks true. It is our time. To discuss all this stuff through, because there's one very popular website, All Things Cherokee, Christina Berry, I believe, and she has a beautiful website, and it's always something about beating, which is good, but for me, I have grown to realize that if it comes out of a glass factory somewhere,
mm-hmm.
and remember, we chiefs, we have to make our own clothes because it's to somebody make our clothes is not chalagi. If in other words, oh, I guess it has something to do with the humbling experience of sitting and making a priest coat. You can't imagine how long that takes. But it's good to be humble and to work at it. And to I was running my medical practice, and then I'd be in the next room making my clothes. And that's just the way it was, and it was in the ancient times, and it is now. So you can buy whatever you wish to wear, things like that. But you have to be real. So you have to go, and you have to put the effort out But it taught me so much. It's not women's work. I mean, it's chalagi work. There is no such thing as higher or lower forms of work.
You know, no wonder I took to needlepoint back in the mid '60s when we were living in Newport Beach and Mom was running a craft store down there. And you know, guy, big burly football players. I can't remember the name of the guy, African American again. He was doing needlepoint too. Who knows?
Oh, Rosie Greer.
Rosie Greer. That's right. You got him.
Yeah. And you know, there's a lot to be said for that it's everything you do has to become with that in mind. It doesn't dictate you, but you dictate it.
Uh-huh.
But all of this stuff is connected. Everything is connected. The Taoists, for example, say from the one came the two, so they had worked themselves up to a thing where they said, well, from one came two, because there's no way that two just existed, and in the Christian Bible, when your listeners feel free to look it up, the first Adam. Testing?
Yes.
Testing.
You hear me?
Okay. Yes. There we go.
Put you back when you were starting to go into explaining about Adam. That's what.
Yeah. So even in Christianity, we have the from the one the two, and so for our concept of one deity now, or could that deity utilize other creatures to deliver messages and such? Absolutely.
Balaam's ass.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Stones.
At the Battle of San Jacinto, the Houston had an eagle come mm-hmm. and circle him and gave him the message that this was the time. So anyway, the spiritual world and the physical world are not separate. We're the ones that are separated from the overall big picture, but we can look at ourselves and see what we're doing. We had so many good things that would have changed the course of our nation that have just been lost, but we can get them back. And matter of fact, it's our responsibility. This is just a another time in our trek. That's all. There is no homeland if you're Chalagi, if you're Chalangi or Charagi, or any one of the names between the original people, the Chalangi, the Charagi, to the Chalagi, which is the way the Iroquois speakers within Cherokee language groups say it. It's all part of the same experience and exodus and journey. Everybody, we have people who think that there's a homeland somewhere. We're on our homeland. We're on this planet somewhere. When we have the four directions We have the heavens above us and the earth below us. We are, each individual Cherokee is the center of his universe at that point, because the motion to move forward is beating in our chest, in our heart, in our soul. We're the ones that are centered. And that's why when we call ourselves the principal people, I mean, win, lose, or draw in our efforts, it matter, this is how we think. We're not invincible. It's not. I'm not taking that standpoint. What I'm trying to say is that even when we lose, we're losing because we chose to fight. And when we win, same thing. But our ability to choose, to have that free will, and to know that we're responsible for the free will and we're responsible for dominion over the earth, and to make sure that this thing gets put right, because the pop culture that's right outside your door, wherever you're hearing me at right now, is not going to take it into account. They don't see it that way. They see it as the earth as a plastic bottle that can be thrown away. Now, recently we had a information from way back within our group when all the Chalaguis went to Mexico in the 1720s. They went and they went to the south and wrote back from Lake Chapala in 1860. The letter was received in Spanish, and it was taken to Mooney, the ethnologist who was in Tahlequah at that time. And it was said in Spanish that we're here at Lake Chapala, where the people who left in 1720, and please tell the tribal families, if they still remember us, that we're here and we're well, and that we went on earlier to the south, going back to Caraqui, the Valley of the Mountains of the, we're going back to the original Catua, our first church, and that's where we're going to find our peace and ourselves. We're going back to the earth, and the others that stayed behind, they were rounded up cruelly, and you know, they always say, well, we were never on a reservation. The what we call the Cherokee Nation today is our wonderful Cherokees up in Oklahoma. Wonderful people, good people, but their history is that, well, we were never on a reservation. But yet, if you read the letters of General Arbuckle, and we've read them all. We have archives here within our nation, the Cherokee Nation of Sequoia, in which we truly know what was what and who was who. And when you read the letters of General Arbuckle, he's very concerned about anything that they say in their government meetings or being reported to him. They're having independent Cherokee government, but the amount of infiltration is huge. And he's completely watching every word that they say, and every other Native American in his district, which included all the Oklahoma people. They were all being watched and monitored, policed, and brought in and admonished for saying this and saying that. Well, the great Sequoia himself wrote a letter, and he said, Chalaguis, come with me to Texas, which was then part of Mexico, and live in freedom with me. Now, Sequoia was giving up his cabin and his political status within the Chalaguis. He was giving up a pension and a salt spring, which produced salt that could be sold. And all of this, he cast it aside. He told his wife, it's all yours. He said, I'm going to live free the rest of my life. And that was his purpose in coming. As he came down to Texas, he used to stay on the Texas border, where the Red River and Arkansas and Louisiana were, and he gave speeches at huge bonfires in which there was every kind of Indian nation represented in the audience. And he would say how we all needed to get together. And it reminded me of the great prophet, that Tecumseh, that said, said the similar things. But Sequoia was thinking kind of out of the box. He said, we're not going to organize here in the middle of a string of military forts running across the wilderness here to where they have the soldiers next door to us. We're going to go into a foreign country, put our roots down there, and organize there. And so he had already figured out, having been a veteran of the Creek Indian War waged by the, he was a veteran of that, and he already had seen how the fighting goes and what takes place. And so he knew that direct confrontation was not the way to do it. And as he was an elder, and a brilliant man, as he was an elder, he had known that the 1720 people did not fight but had left. And he saw during that time period those that had chosen to fight were destroyed by this machine that came out of Europe with its religion that allows you to take somebody's land and not to ethically even be considered yourself a bad person for doing such. Because they had brown skin, it wasn't their land to begin with. So that kind of thought was rampant, and the entire white nation thought that way. The only time anybody ever made peace or gave a Native American a piece of land was because they were in fear of losing their land through war. And those times had long since passed. So their motivation was to stall us what was ours. And the only thing that they really can't take that is ours is this concept of who we're supposed to be, who we think we're supposed to be. They can't take that from you. And this business I love the jewelry, the beads. I love the clothing and things like that. But for me at this age, I'm no longer a young person. I know that for me, I'll take something simple and something that I made myself, or something that came out of a mussel shell somewhere of humble origin, because it's worth more than any amount of gold. The concept of the concept of Cherokee heaven is a good example of how we think, because the early missionaries would ask the Chalagi, if you do what we say, and the story I like best is an old one, and I know you've heard this, Blue Otter, as you probably heard everything. But anyway, I know you've heard this, where the Monrovian missionaries came to him and they asked the chief standing there, they said, listen, we have a book here, and we'd like to bring it, being the Bible, we'd like to bring this to your people and read it to your people. And he says, well, what's in the book? This was, I think, in the 1760s. And they said, well, wonderful stories. And he goes, and where did you get this book? Oh, well, we've had this book for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, more than you could count. And he said, I see. So leave your translator here. You people leave. And then come back in spring after the winter snows, and I'll give you a decision. And so they did. And so every day, the translator would come, and he would read the Bible to Standing Bear. And so when they came to back in spring, the Monrovian missionaries came, and Standing Bear said, "Well, I'm sorry, but I'm not going to allow you to read the book to my people." And they said, "Why? What did you see in the book that disturbed you?" And so And he said, well, nothing in the book disturbed me. I mean, we don't agree with some parts of it, things like that, but basically it's wonderful stories. Well, then why won't you let us read it to your people? He said, well, because you're liars. And the Monrovian missionary said, we're liars? He goes, yes, you're liars. He said, well, chief, why would you say that about us? He says, well, I have been watching your people for a long time. And you say that you've had this book for a long time. He said, I know you're lying, because how could a person have had this book for hundreds and hundreds of years and still act the way you do?
Yeah.
Be gone. And so they left.
Well, you know, we had the Ark. You know, we had records on metal plates, and it was the doom of the Uka anciently. And here's a guy, he always wore white. He was carried around in a sedan chair, so his feet didn't touch the ground. He lived in a stone house. And his one and only job, really, was to go to every town and read the law every year. And,
right.
You know, if you told that to a rabbi, he'd say, oh, my gosh, you know, that it's kosher to live in a stone house. You know, it's kosher to wear white.
Yes. Yes, it is. And we're going to get into that part of it just ever so shortly. The Uk also was not to hunt deer, and was to partake only of the things that moved fast, that had the most life in them, because when you match up the ancient Cherokee's dietary practices with the people that were captured, trapped, and the deer was gone from their land. And the streams were dammed up, and they were reduced eating things that the older Cherokee generations would not consider food. Catfish was one of the things because of its fat content. The gar. Now I have some wonderful Uchi friends that were down in Mexico seeing me. And the Mexican word for garfish is chicharrones de Catan, and so I ordered them in a restaurant, and they weren't Spanish speakers, my Uchi friends, and they said, what did you order? And I said, well, see if you like it. And so they brought the garfish out that had been cut into strips and basically fried. And it tastes better than, and I've had filet of sole at the Jockey Club in Washington with Eunice Shriver sitting, you know, a few chairs away. And so I know what best cuisine is. I'd rather have the gar, actually. It's way tastier. It makes halibut look inedible. So we had the garfish that we would eat, and the deer that we would eat, but we would not eat it to excess because 38% of the food we ate was high fiber, and that's one reason why we have diabetes in Cherokee people. It's at such a high rate. We no longer eat the foods that we were taught to eat in the early days by the religious practitioners. The priest, like you said, the Uku would come and give the law, the dietary laws, too. We would not eat squirrel or possum, and when the Spanish De Soto brought pigs, we knew by the shape of the animal and its foot that we were going to eat it. We already knew that. When they got there, we had known that. Let's see, we're talking 1451 to 2050 years. We'd known that, not to eat pig. And so those Cherokees, Chalakis that are listening, it wouldn't hurt you a little bit to kind of think over some of these things. And now in science, that they were right. And so it's just a matter of little steps to change this and change that. We all have got to work toward being a principled person, a person that stands for something and something good. You got to just draw your line in the sand and say, well, this is who we're going to be. It's like Pappy Hicks said, don't lie to anybody. And so that's the key. Now, our religion afforded us an opportunity. That we're we're taking the opportunity to return to a group of people part of some information that belongs to them, because whenever a Chalagi finds that somebody left something of value in their possession that's not yours, and I remember this best taught to me when I was young. I saw an arrowhead, and they said, "Well, is that your arrowhead?" And I, "Yes, it is." And I said, "Whoa, really? You're very skilled. You made one beautifully." And it was a man point. It was a war point. And I said, "Oh, no, I didn't make it." "Oh, well, then it's not yours." And they're right. It wasn't mine. And so we try not to pick up artifacts because, A, if you make it, don't pick it up. If we have people that come and give us incredible artifacts, and I tell them, "Where did you get this?" They tell me, "Well, there's a mound, such and such." I said, "No, no, take it back. Take it back and tell them you're sorry." And I always do the same story on them. "Wow, you made this. This is really beautiful." "Oh, I didn't make that. You didn't make this out of flint?" "No, no." Then who did? "I thought you said it was yours." And so they said, "No, it wasn't. No, no, it isn't mine." I said, "I see. So you're giving me somebody else's property. Is that it? Where did you find this?" And so we have them take it back because it's not ours. So you have to watch out on keeping things that are not yours, regardless of if they're tangible or intangible. We try to return to people any property that we have of theirs. One of the things that we're in the process of returning right now is that the Mormon religion, in 1843, the founder, Joseph Smith, and I'm a priest within our priests of the ancient Cherokee Church of One God, Yohiwa, which is the oldest name known to man of in historical times, the written of the One God. We'll get into that later. But anyway, we have these Hebrew dietary laws in which it doesn't hurt to experiment and start taking it. If you haven't eaten and it's time to eat no more than what will fill both of your hands as you cup them together, whatever it is. But try to eat things that are more alive and more wild. In other words, lean meat. Eat your tougher meats instead of your fat-filled meats. Eat the things that are green because they have the energy of the sun in them.
Live foods.
And if you're looking to just have a bite of something and you're in a place that only sells high fat foods that a Cherokee would not feed his children nor his elders, so like buffalo hump, they would not feed them. If they couldn't get gar out of a river or bass or something that was top water and moving, they would not eat the bottom dwellers. They knew that the amount of fat on them was a problem, and they could tell the difference in their performance, and they knew that their body was telling them not to do it. The yams are always good to eat. The yams are wonderful. The wild yam, especially. But fresh water, that water which runs, the spring water, even all of it's connected, and all of it has life in it. So I guess what I'm trying to say is a modern-day Chalagi is that if you wish to just have something, to eat that which will fill one hand, and you can have it seven times a day. So you eat a little bit here and a little bit there and a little bit here and a little bit there, and try to eat one or two things at a time, because that was the way it was done. The only time that they had multiple pots of food sitting about was on special celebrations, because the people that were coming to worship or to have a meeting signifying So what we have, it's a piece of information that belongs to the people of Mormon. In ancient times, the people who came from the salt water, when they came to us after having crossed the Atlantic Ocean, their immigration story became our immigration story because our blood mixed. So when you hear the Cherokee migration legend of we crossed over land for a great time, we came to the ocean, we built spouse, and then we crossed on faith alone, and we came to the Americas. That's the short story. The long story is that these people intermarried with us, vice versa, as seagulls marry seagulls and doves marry doves, people of equal talent and intelligence. The Choctaw received quite a bit of the word too, and the Guaymi and all kinds of other tribes, from as we worked our way north, received this type of Hebrew word or that type of Hebrew word, and it's found in this huge matrix coming across the United States. But the main vein, as has been recorded by English authors from 1690 to 1825, were the Chalagee people and the R speakers especially. After they had left in 1720, there were still several hundreds and hundreds of people who practiced their religion in Hebrew. So to make a long story short, we know that how to pronounce and what the word Mormon actually means. In 1843, Joseph Smith, to his credit, could not explain what the word Mormon meant. And instead of making up a name, he simply said, it's unknown to us. He could have said something popular. He could have said something that was in demand. He could have lied. He could have made it so obscure that nobody could have known what he was saying. He didn't do any of those things. He basically said, I don't know, and our generation, it will not be known. And so at that time, 164 years ago, it has not been known what the word Mormon meant. Now, the word Mormon, and I'll tell you exactly what it means. You have to look at the word from the right to the left, and Mon is the Reformed Egyptian meaning a multitude of people crying out for. And then Rish is a leader of man, not of men, but of man, of a large group of humankind. And then Mo is an Egyptian, is from the water, but it was fresh water as the word came into Hebrew from Moses. But in Cherokee, and this is the key. To just one of the many keys we have to Hebrew, is that there's a Cherokee usage of that same thing in the Cherokee language. And in the Cherokee language, Mo means from the salt water. And same thing with Moroni. O-N-I meant a gift in Egyptian. And it meant a child is coming in Oni in Hebrew. But in Cherokee, it means from a long time back came forth the gift. And then you got to the Rish part again, which is a leader of man, and then the Mo part, who came from the salt water. So we're the guys who are looking out at the ocean. We're the guys that understand that these people and these words that we're speaking came from the salt water to the Americas. And so we're the key to... Did that happen? Because, and when I say key, we have hundreds and hundreds of pages of Adair and Payne and Beltram all writing down the Hebrew words, and they're numerous. We have in South Carolina places, there's one phrase that in Hebrew means God is in the middle of the mount, which means not the interior of the mountain so much as in the elevation is not at the top but in the middle, which is where the ketubah often was built, because if you're on the very peak, you have lightning problems, and you want to be down where it's not just straight up and straight down, that type of thing. So anyway, God is in the middle of the mountains. And if you look at it in Cherokee and you look at what it means in Cherokee, it means he is in the middle of the mountains. He. They use the ancient term for the middle concept of God, Yehovah, and the he part is the intelligence, the intellect, the wisdom. The Yod is the spiritual part, the spirit of God. And he is the intellectual part, the planner, the creator. And wa is the love of God for the universe and for us. And so Yehovah is from the one came the two. There you have it. And either you have to make a choice as a Chalagi, are you going to believe in magic to where things came from nothing? Or are you going to believe that it has always been and will always be? And so I warn people about thinking that the universe is going to disappear. We humans might disappear if we don't change our ways. That's completely possible because it's within our free will. But don't think it's an act of God. It's an act of human ignorance and disobedience to our own intellect over who and what we should be, especially when we have all of this technology handed down to us as Native Americans. It's ridiculous that we're ignoring it.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that the Cherokees, I mean, we love the white people. We love their technology. Boy, we adopted as much as we could, as fast as we could, but along with the concomitant problems that... See, this is, it kind of reminds me of what I believe it was Sitting Bull said. He said, you know, in life, he says, you just have to consider everything. And he says, and with a breath of kindness, blow the bad away.
That's right. Sam Houston used to say that John Jolly had taught him when he first became a waif with them and was living among the Cherokee. John Jolly, he asked him, what is your religion? And he goes, well, he said, it's this way. He said, there are good people, and there are people who have chosen to be bad people. And there are good places, and then there are dangerous places. You need to stay away from the dangerous places and the bad people. You should decide that.
Hmm.
And that's it.
Yep. Yep, make good choices.
Yeah, make good choices. Think with your choose heart.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you'll make mistakes, but the intellect cannot be depended upon because pretty soon the means to the end is there's no parameters when you don't use your
and
heart.
It does, it doesn't hurt to have a direct connection with Creator. You know, we've been pumping this for years now, and it's like, you know, my wife's been very ill for the last 7 weeks or so with panic disorder, and you and I have been talking about this. And night before last, yes. About 4 o'clock in the morning, I woke up out of this dream, and it scared me. But when I thought about the dream, I'd asked the previous night before. I said, look, you know, what do I need to do to treat my wife and to help her out? Well, in this dream, all the houses were rusty. And oh my gosh, it was just terrible. And and I went into this one building, and there was a woman in there. Something about me renting a truck from her or something. But she was selling ice cream cones, and I said, "Oh, well, what do you dip them in?" "Oh, we dip them in vitamin such and such." Well, it took me, you know, a couple of days to figure out, hey, that's Creator's way of telling me. And Creator, if you can decode his language, because he speaks in reverb pictures, sometimes with his voice, sometimes he'll just come right out and tell you. But what I got out of that was she's rusty. She's got oxidation, and she needs antioxidants, and she needs vitamins.
Yes.
It's like everybody's read the parable of the 10 virgins, and you know, it takes time to understand the language and to learn what it is Creator driving at.
And it's Blue Otter, that is such a good point, and that into itself is something that, that we need to learn, because as in Isaiah 55:8-9, it says, "I do not look like you, I do not think like you, for I am the Lord, and I am above you." And so when we get to this image thing of being in his image, we're going to have to understand that what he's saying is that we have free will.
Uh-huh.
And that's what counts. We're thinking, listen, if the creator of all things, Uneklahi, Yohiwa, the God of creation, if his hair is getting gray, we're in real trouble.
And there's something about this DNA thing, this ladder, because the oldest represents, I mean, the Abrahamic language came out of what's now Sumeria, and the early Sumerians' depictions of the Tree of Life look like a spiral. And folks, I'm a BYU graduate. I belong to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints since 1977. I was trained in the church education by Stephen Iba, and I noticed things like in the Salt Lake Temple and the Logan Temple, there are spiral staircases, one going up, one coming down, and we're just now beginning to decode what's going on in the universe. And if you're a Mormon, if you've been in the church more than a couple of years, I know, you're probably tired of going to conference every few months, and you're waiting. And bated breath, something big's going to happen, something, and it just never seems to. And it's like, your friend in Marlon Jensen said, people are leaving the church in droves. And, everybody's looking for something.
It's right.
You got to go within yourself. And that's what Joseph Smith was doing. And in 2 Nephi chapter 3, he was searching for that seer that they were told up till 1909 would be a future Indian seer, Indian prophet. He was on his way to the Rockies. He had crossed the Mississippi River. He was in Iowa. He wasn't going back. He had concluded that the Latter-day Saints were dumb and stupid, that trying to teach them truth was like trying to split wood with a corn dodger for a wedge, and a beetle for he says you try to teach shatter like glass, and he was so much ahead of his time. He, Sidney Rigdon, was his spokesman for a while, and he would get all huffy about priesthood, and one guy hollered to him in one meeting, "Well, Sidney, there's 30 women in this audience got more priesthood than you do," and. It's just the Latter-day Saints were the most of them. They were stayed kind of most of them came out of the Northeast. They had all their preconceived notions, and Joseph was told that if he lived to be 85 years old, he'd see Jesus again, and that's in every DNC that the every Mormon carries if you got a triple combination, And Brigham Young followed up on. He got out there and got into the Black Hawk Wars and. Pretty much concluded that Indians were heathens, died in 1877. And then in 1889, in an Indian reservation several hundred miles west of Salt Lake near Silver City, Nevada, surrounded by military, here comes Indians from all over North and South America, as far north as Alaska and far south as Tierra del Fuego, all called the Walker Lake. And there's this guy that comes among them, and later on, there are three witnesses. And remember the law of three witnesses: Wovoka, a porcupine, and one other. I can't remember right now, but they all said that it was Jesus. And once you'd met him and shook hands with him, you could see him anytime you wanted to. He has such apostles among them, and what happened? The Book of Mormon says that it would come forth from among the Gentiles. Joseph Smith said, we are identified with the Gentiles. Brigham Young later got off on this tangent. He was even calling Jews Gentiles. And but, you know, 1890 was that year. And 4 or 5 days after Joseph Smith's 85th birthday, the massacre at Wounded Lake happened, Wounded Knee happened, because of what happened with the introduction of the so-called ghost dance, which is really the original the dance of welcome and friendship. And this movement swept the country, scared the death out of the Indian agents. And the 7th Cavalry, they wanted revenge for what happened 14 years previous. They were the people that came in, killed 300 unarmed men, women, and children. Yeah. And so one of Joseph Smith's wives, I think it was Sarah, wrote a letter to the Salt Lake paper and said, hey, this has happened. This has fulfilled that prophecy. You know, and they kind of looked at it and, you know, and it went over their head. And I was led to this through dreams and voices I had in 1984, 1985, and kind of got off on a tangent, you know, met Rolling Thunder in 1990. And what I've taken away from this is that not just Last Saints, but everybody just needs to get back in touch with their Creator, relearn His language, and then we can go forward.
Yeah, and remember, he doesn't right. speak as we speak, and so we've got to obey the approach that we've got to approach with our heart. It can't be just verbiage. You can't mm-hmm. say something and not mean it. The Chalagi were famous for not having a word for the word promise, because if a chief said something, it was a promise. Well, it's been wonderful,
Thank
Blue
you.
Otter.
Thank you so much
for your time and your knowledge. And you're a great guide to this new medium that I'm unused to. After our 10 years of seeking that which is true, we're ready. We're opening our roles. We're growing huge. We're giving back to the Mormons what is theirs, the meaning of the word Mormon and Moroni, which is a very good meaning. And as you are a Mormon and I am not, we agree upon that. And that's the least of the stuff that we agree upon, because if there's probably no end.
Oh yeah, you know, I'm not just a Mormon. You know, I've gone on and studied.
I know
Torah,
that. I know.
You know, and you know, right now, I'm not sure how any of it works.
I'm sure of one thing, though, that if we don't start treating each other as brothers and sisters, if we don't lose our provincial attitudes of this versus that, or these people versus those people, we will never have lived during our time on Earth. So we need to see each other as human beings and to see the Earth as ours. And we need to take care of it. We need to move forward. Nothing can stop us if we do that. We have the authority to do that. And I'm not talking just Chalagis. I'm talking about we all have the authority to do that, because we are here. And we have free will, and that was done by the Creator. It's the ball is in our court. It is our turn at bat. Whatever analogy you want to use, it is our responsibility. But as far as allowing things to haul us off mentally through alcohol abuse or vanity of beads or whatever, and we don't get to see each other, this is ridiculous. We need to all come together regardless of what tribe we are.
Well, hey, I appreciate you. Well, good night.
Okay, bye-bye.
Gagawig, I love you.
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. This station's only means of support is through donations and purchases.
I'm Austin Powers. I like Gas Mojo. The very sexy and very sweet stone, yeah.
But you gotta have Gas Mojo, baby, yeah!
What a gas, baby, yeah!
I'm going to go back to the 60s and steal Austin Powers' Gas Mojo.
Hi, folks. This is Will Bluewater speaking on behalf of GasMojo.net Engine Booster. Immediate 25% fuel savings with GasMojo.net in just 5 minutes after installation. And your grandma can do it, so you just strap it on your fuel line, folks. Some customers report much greater savings. The GasMojo.net Engine Booster catalytically conditions any hydrocarbon fuel, be it gasoline, propane, diesel fuel. It's not a filter, it contains no metals, magnets, or toxic substances, and uses no electricity. The GasMojo.net Engine Booster unit is a specially designed tube containing a completely safe proprietary media. It's a passive fuel treatment process designed to disperse hydrocarbons for better performance and mileage, and also to break down carbon and other contaminants. Unlock your fuel's hidden energy potential now with GasMojo.net. And folks, you get a 100% money-back guarantee on this. I've got one on my car. It was developed by an old friend of mine, and he's an honorable person. You got to try it, folks, and go open a bank account now for all the money you're going to save. GasMojo.net, GasMojo.net. Just do it.
just while you can. There's a mighty dark cloud hanging overhead. Oh yeah, hang overhead. Let the wind blow, let the truth be known for all mankind again. Let the wind blow, let the truth.